Well, good morning, everyone. For those of you that don't know, my name is Ryan, and I am the pastor here. I've been away on holidays for a few weeks now. And so, as is the practice, when you come back from holidays, every sermon feels like your first sermon ever. So I'm feeling a bit rusty and trepidatious. But more than anything, I just feel privileged. I think being away always makes me miss you, miss my job, because talking about Jesus from the Holy Scriptures is one of the greatest privileges of my life. And so to be gathered with you, to open the Word together, is something I'm very excited for today. Now, we've been in a series through the summer, back through the spring, on the parables of Jesus. Coming up in September, I'm going to be launching a new series, and we're going to be talking about some long-term vision stuff. So these last weeks in the Gospel of Matthew will be our last weeks in this Gospel. And we're doing so by really unpacking these parables of Jesus. Now, what's nice about doing them together, like doing them back to back to back to back, is you see the patterns. You start to see that Jesus has a point that he's trying to make with these parables. And these parables are just different stories, just different analogies trying to explain the same thing. He's trying to help people understand, first and foremost, who is God? What is God's plan of salvation? Like, how does God work? And then he's essentially trying to help people understand, why is all this good news? Like, when you look at Jesus, you see his ministry, you hear his words, you see his character and his personality, you go, dang, he is good. Like, the more you look at Jesus, the more you think, man, he's good. In a world with not a lot of good, it's quite surprising how good Jesus is. Fair? So, all those who are following Jesus in his goodness are trying to figure out, why is there so much conflict if Jesus is so good? Why is there so much drama? Why is this so difficult if Jesus is so good? And so this is something that Jesus is consistently trying to go, this always happens when God is doing good in the world. There's also negative. There's also evil at work in the world, and this is how you should understand it. So what we come to today is the parable of the wedding feast, and this highlights this combination of, here's the generosity and goodness of God coming, but not everybody is going to respond positively to it. So let's unpack this story together, beginning in verse 1. And again, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king. Now notice these words, may be compared. So these parables aren't the perfect representation of all of the gospel or all of God's character. He's taking a well-known ancient story and he's repurposing it to show, look at how this does reveal some things about God and does reveal some things about the gospel. So the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son and sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast. So he sets up the parable by introducing us to a king who is celebrating the wedding of his son and his heir. So in his joy, the king invites all of the people that a king would normally invite to a feast and a celebration like this. Now, a feast such as this would always act to secure the succession. Okay, this is a move by the king to go, let's bring all the important people here to celebrate, yes, the union of my son, and all those gathered should affirm not only the marriage, but his future reign as well, right? So he's propping his son up to say, celebrate my son, because he's going to be your king. And the marriage is a great opportunity to do this. For those of you that secretly watch Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, this is the kind of thing that's happening, is that he's setting up the succession of his son. But what does it say afterwards? They would not come. His invitation is ignored. In traditional societies, this is an unthinkable act. So now, it's helpful for us. We're not in this kind of traditional society that sees a monarchy and necessarily respects it as default. Some of you that are older are like, yes, we do. Okay, but in this post-colonial kind of society that we live in now, we read this and go, maybe the king deserves for people not to show up to his wedding feast, his son's wedding feast. Maybe he's a bad king. Maybe he's an evil king. Maybe he's an exploitive king. And this refusal to go is a righteous refusal. Maybe it's a righteous resistance to his empirical, cruel reign. But what we see in verse 4 reveals the kind of king that Jesus sees God as. And it's a king of humble character. So look at verse 4. Again, he sent other servants, saying, tell those who were invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves, have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. So what we see of the king's character, his automatic response is not wrathful. Notice that? It's not angry. It's also not fueled by fearful insecurity that's grasping at his power. It's a response that seems to actually believe the best of everyone's refusal. He responds by saying, oh, send more servants because they must just not understand how good the feast is. They must not have understood that the feast is ready. They must not have understood how generous my heart is. So his response is to go, they must have just missed something. Let's tell them again. Isn't that gracious? Isn't it humble? It's not super insecure. He's just going, oh, he's believing the best about them in this moment. So tell them about the oxen, the fattened calves, and how everything is ready for them. They just have to come. He does not initially have the eyes to see their evil. He's almost devotedly positive, not to be confused with naivety. He's positive on purpose. So what this means is not only is the king good in this story and generous, but their refusal is rooted in a power struggle where they do not recognize the king or his heir. And this is how Jesus understands the heart and character of God. This is his point. He wants you to see that God and how he works in the universe and how he interacts with humanity is like this. He's generous. He's inviting. He wants them to come. He's even gracious in his view towards people. But there's something at work in the world that is breaking that relationship. And so Jesus is also saying in this parable that this is the nature of sin. That sin, what's wrong in the world, is a rejection of the generosity of God. Do you see it? So verse 5 says, here's their response to the second set of servants coming with the invitations. But they paid no attention and went off, one to his farm, another to his business. So Jesus highlights two categories of rejection. There's a passive rejection and there's an aggressive rejection, which we're going to look at in a minute. When looking at the passive rejection, Jesus says that their hearts did what? Paid no attention to the king's goodness. So part of rejection is just being busy, which is actually helpful to consider even in terms of thinking about my own parentage. My own parenting is to go, busyness can come across as what? Rejection. Distractedness can come across in a marriage as what? Rejection. So where are their attentions? They're fixed upon what? Their responsibilities. There's a rejection of the king and the abundance of his generosity that comes from their perceived self-sufficiency. Either I can take care of myself or I need to take care of myself, or I don't need you. I've got it covered. What they're doing is going about their daily business and saying, I don't have room for that. I'm busy doing this. This is how Jesus sees kind of the average person's rejection of God. It's very Canadian. Don't outright reject the king to his face, but instead just be too busy. Right? I got a lot going on. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand the feeling of having responsibilities. And to live each day with a family of seven, there's always a major schedule. We're coming to terms with this someday. By the time I get this, it'll be over, I figure. Is the needs of a family of this size, the schedules that have to be juggled, all the, that's hard work. I understand that. You're right to prioritize. And no, you can't be at everything that goes on all the time. And that doesn't always mean you're rejecting the person or the thing that you can't go to. I understand that. But here we're saying it's like a fundamental to how you live your life is there room to prioritize the king's feast? It's a good reminder for us to be, do we prioritize the Lord's table in our life? Do we actually live our life knowing Sunday's coming, of which I eat afresh of the grace I need, not only to survive, but to thrive? This is not just a memorial act. It's a necessity to hear the gospel and receive the gospel. Now, verse 6, Jesus goes on, while the rest of these people didn't just passively reject the king's invitation, the rest seized the servants, treated them shamefully, and killed them. Now, the second group of rejectors is not sinning by not paying attention. They're sinning through great attention. And their attention is directed towards who in this story? To the servants. So their independence, their self-sufficiency is so fueled by pride, the pride of their accomplishments, that they see themselves not only as rivals to the king, but as greater than the king. His invitation to that kind of heart, come to my table, feast on my generosity, is seen as demeaning. It's received as demeaning towards their greatness. And it justifies their hatred for the king because his rule threatens their divine vision or aspirations for themselves. So they view it with hostility. Pride hears the gospel and hears it as hostility. You hear me? This is how Jesus sees the violent rejectors of his time. Whether it's the pagan Romans or the Pharisees themselves, or we could put them all in the same category. Those who hear the gospel and are angered by it, that makes them feel, how dare you offer me salvation? How dare you imply that I would need you? How dare you attack my autonomy? This is what Jesus is saying. This is the response to the gospel because the heart gets hard in prideful self-sufficiency. Now, they take this hatred for God out on who? The servants. And so it says they seize the servants, treat them shamefully. I'm assuming some kind of like torture, and ultimately kills them. This is how Jesus is trying to help his disciples understand this is why the Pharisees hate you. This is why the Sadducees are against me. This is why they're not hearing the offer of the king as good news. They feel it as a threat. Now you, and for those of you that have been in our church for a long time, you would have heard me address false shepherds, wolves in the church, many times. And they come out of the teachings of Jesus. And so I talk about abuses of power in the church and clergy who misuse their authority. I've pushed that for many years. I've talked about that a lot. But here we see the opposite, where good servants are mistreated by those they have been sent to benefit and to bless. Just as the Old Testament prophets are often maligned and killed by the people of Israel, so the Pharisees conspire and succeed in killing Jesus the Son, as they did the New Testament apostles in the following years. And continuing for generations and generations in the church, powerful minorities do this stuff in churches to this day. Attack pastors, attack those who have been sent to preach the gospel to them. So Jesus is showing here, yes, there's a passive rejection to the gospel, but also there's an aggressive one that's fueled by pride. And it'll have all kinds of different justifications, but you'll know it by its violence. You could tell by its heart to wound and to hurt. Now, what's the king's response to this kind of treatment of his servants? Verse 7 says, the king was angry. And he sent his troops and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. So does this go unnoticed by the king? Of course not. Jesus says the king rightly becomes angry and sends his troops to destroy these murderers and all that they drew their pride from, their cities. In his justice, he answers their violence with retribution and crushes essentially their rebellion. Verse 8, then he said to his servants, the wedding feast is ready, but those invited were not worthy. So all of the people that you would assume worthy of a king's feast, the religious, the devout, the powerful, in reality, Jesus is saying were not worthy. Blinded by their high views of themselves, they missed the honor offered by the king's friendship. And what does the king then do? He does not rescind his generosity and close the gates and say, fine, we'll just feast with my family. Instead, he expands his generosity. He broadens it, further revealing his character of humility and generosity. Who does he invite? Verse 9, go therefore to the main roads and invite to the wedding feast as many as you find. Basically, the king is saying, go to the edges of my kingdom, especially the roads, even the people who are passing through it. Find anybody you can get your hands on and bring them to my table and my feast. The lowly, seemingly forgotten, the poor, the traveler, all those you would assume not get invited or would not want to come, invite them. This is the heart of the king. And notice the responsibility entrusted to his servants is to be liberal with their invitation, not to be limiting or suspicious. He's not saying, go out into my kingdom and vet anyone you come across and decide, are you worthy? Might you be worthy of coming to the king's feast? No, the heart, Jesus is saying, of God is get your hands on anyone you can. Anyone who will say yes, bring them. Is this good news? This is what's at the heart of the gospel. Get your hands on anybody. The amount of times we hear, I can't come to your church, my life's a mess. And every Christian who knows the gospel goes, that's the point. It makes you more qualified, not less. The bigger the mess, the more qualified you are to come. Not because this is a fix-you project, but because you can see your need for God's love and generosity. So verse 10, those servants went out into the roads and gathered all whom they found, both bad and good. So the wedding hall was filled with guests. Jesus says they gathered all who they found because all whom they found were more willing to come. Why? Because they were not blinded by their self-sufficiency. This is the heart of the Beatitudes at the beginning of Matthew chapter 5. They're blessed because they see their need for a feast. Who's most likely to say yes to a meal? The hungry person, right? And this is the point, is that this feast is wasted, so to speak, in this story on the rich, because their bellies are full. I've taken care of myself. I have no need of a king and no need of your generosity. I can make a feast for myself. But those who hunger and thirst for a feast, when they hear this invitation, what do they say? Thank God, I'm starving. And this is what Jesus is saying the gospel is like. To those who actually need it, see their need for it, and want it, they'll hear the gospel and go, finally, a solution to all of this mess in my life that I'm just trying to keep contained. This is why this church is full of very sinful people. Amen? Because we came here looking for what? A savior. Yes? We're not playing religious games. They're lame and overdone. We're here because we want a solution to life's greatest problems. Yes? And here, Jesus is saying, to the hungry, the feast is a delight. It's not annoying to be invited. It's not an interruption to our busyness or an insult to our significance because we can see the truth that we need it. We need him. And humility allows us to see the invitation for what it is, an honor and a blessing more than I deserve. And so he highlights that, both the good and the bad. Because the lowly of this world, those in low stations within our society, are filled with good and bad people. Those who hear about a feast and go, oh man, could I ever use that? Those who hear about salvation in Jesus, forgiveness of sins, the restoration of life, a healing from the brokenness of our stories, a renewed sense of purpose and calling in Christ, those who hear that and go, that's what I need, are both good and bad people. Because bad people have made a mess of their lives through their own decisions. I'm a good mix of both, I figure. And good people have gone through hard, terrible things in this broken world that they didn't deserve and they didn't choose and aren't their fault, and they've still been plundered. The lowly spaces are full of the good and the bad, and let's be honest, we're a bit of both. Fair? My mess is of my own making, and my mess has been made by this broken world. Both are welcome at the feast of the King. And either way, we should rejoice in our lowliness because we're better able to receive the King's invitation because of it. Do you hear that? Your lowliness, even your brokenness, is a gift because it gives you the eyes to see the beauty and the need for the gospel. Verse 11. But when the king came in to look at the guests, he saw there a man who had no wedding garment. Now here's a bit of a twist in the story. Imagine this moment. The king comes in and kind of inspects the room. Who's here? Who came? Of all the people gathered, every single one that he sees is this approving gaze. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. Oh, I'm so glad you responded. You can see the king going through, oh, you came? I'm so glad you came. And then he comes to one person, of all the people gathered, and he sees this man, catches his eye, and stands out from everybody else, because he's not wearing a wedding garment. Filled with curiosity, he turns to him and asks a question. And I appreciate the graciousness of asking a question before assuming. But the question the king asks is, friend, notice the title, friend, how'd you get in here without a wedding garment? He's not quick to condemn, but he's asking for an explanation. And by saying, how did you get in, what he's really saying is, why did you come like this? To come without a wedding garment is to say, I deserve to come. And not only do I deserve to come, but I don't even need to dress up for it. Yeah, I'll come, but I'll show in my dress that my heart is not really in it. What does the man have to say for himself? How does the man respond or rebuttal or explain? Like, does he say, well, they asked me and I didn't have time to change? No, instead, what we see is he's speechless. Because somehow he knows that he can't deceive the king. There's no explanation. He knew he did not really have a solid defense because he did it on purpose. He didn't think he needed it. It's a way of saying, I understand this is a big party and a big celebration, but I don't really want to come. But I'll grace you with my presence anyway. I won't get ready. I won't wear what we typically wear in our society to this kind of event. Instead, I'll just show up and be like, well, I came. Gotta count for something. What's he gonna say to the king? I don't think this feast is a big deal. It's a bit beneath me. But in the end, what we see is that his silence is a self-condemnation. Once the man condemns himself, then the punishment and the consequence is just logical. This is a great picture of what the final judgment will look like in the way of Jesus. Before Christ, all humanity will be struck by perfect self-awareness. No defense mechanisms, no justifications, no arguments, just honesty with God and yourself, an honesty that will self-condemn. And the reformers see this whole picture of the parable of essentially the man is trying to still come by his own merits. He still thinks he earns his place at the feast. That it's a failure in the gospel to actually receive what Jesus is giving by grace. I will do the work to save you. You don't have to achieve this yourself. And here this man is saying, I think I've done a pretty good job. I don't need it. Now the patristics, which is the early church, they see it as someone who has come and failed to work out the grace of Jesus in their lives to the point where they actually love other people and they actually live in charity towards others. That they've worked out righteousness to the point where they're wearing white. They believe the gospel not only saves them but changes them to be loving towards others. Fundamentally, what we see in this story is somebody come and say, I don't need the garments because I'm not celebrating. Just here for the food. For Jesus, what he's getting at is you can try and skirt your way through this life saying, yeah, I'm a Christian. Yeah, I'm a follower of Jesus. But if it's inauthentic, if it's really just a cover-up for more self-righteousness, and more independence, and more self-sufficiency, and a high view of yourself, that Christianity is like a brooch you wear to go, look how beautiful I am. You're missing out on it all, and you're going to figure that out when it's too late. And there won't be a rebuttal. There won't be a justification. You can't fake it when you stand before God and go, I knew. I just didn't care. I thought I was good enough. Verse 14, Jesus ends with these words, for many are called, but few are chosen. How many are invited to the feast in this parable? All of them. Many. How many respond to the calling? Few. And even of those who do respond, not all will be chosen. Why? Because when dealing with the things pertaining to salvation and the restoration of the world, God is looking for true authenticity. He wants those who show up to the feast to have real trust in him, real humility, real repentance, real change of life, and real love. love above all for the son, for the heir, for the future king. He wants them to come and not just bend the knee in fear of his power and retribution. He wants them to come in love with the king. All of this is saying you can't fake it. Be honest about where you're really at with God and honest about where you're really at with the gospel and choose authentically from the heart who you will trust, who you are going to put all of the weight of your life on. Is it going to be your own efforts? Are you going to take care of yourself forever? Or are you going to let God love you? When you hear this parable, who do you see as responsible for there being few who are chosen? Is it the whole point of this parable to go, look how nitpicky this king really is? He's looking for opportunities to kick people out of his feast. Does it feel like that? But isn't that how we kind of naturally tend to think about God? Does this parable represent a God like that? I can't hear you. Unless you're really thinking, I could start over. It's not. What's the will of the king in this parable? What's his will, his desire? That all would come. Is it him in the end that's pushing people away and making it really hard to get in? At the end, even the one that he asks, that he removes, I shouldn't say ask, that he actually, in judgment, removes from the feast, is the one who's being inauthentic in his heart to go, you didn't want to be here anyway, so why'd you come? Be honest with yourself. You didn't want to come. And it made sense that he'd be removed from the feast. And having been removed from the feast in the dark of the night, he would feel the regret of his choices. He would feel the pain of and hear the laughter, hear the feasting, hear the joy, and find himself standing in the dark, separate from that presence of goodness, and regret it painfully. So here in this whole parable, it reveals all of this, but let me tell you, let me end with this. The gospel is even better than this parable. The full gospel is even better than this parable. Because the king is inviting the people to come and give their allegiance to the son by being married to the son. This wedding feast in the gospel is a welcome for you to come, be united to the son. Be loved as the bride of the Son. This is how Jesus talks about his church, as his bride. To become heirs and adopted children through union with the Son. So everything the Son is an heir to, in the gospel, those who are united to the Son share in it. You're not just witnessing the celebration of the Son, you're in it as part of the celebration at the head table in union with Jesus. That's how good the gospel is. It's a celebration of your homecoming, of your ascension into the love of the King through his Son. And the response of many is sadly the same today, rejecting his invitation, choosing self-provision over his divine inheritance, killing and harming his servants. But the will of the King is to have you. The will of the king is that many would respond to his invitation and be welcomed to the feast. And among those who are gathered are going to be some imposters, but he will work it out with them directly. So as we hear all of this, it should make us go, take stock. What is my response to this invitation? Is it a passive rejection? Is it a violent rejection? And if so, is it warranted? Do I really want to keep living on my own? Do I really want to resist the king and try to be my own king? Or do I want to be a part of this generosity, this welcome into love, this welcome into the family, this welcome into transformation? Jesus is saying, not only is this a good gift now, but it's a good gift forever. You cannot fight the goodness of God unscathed. It'll cost you everything. But if you give yourself to the goodness of God, you gain everything. This is the invitation of the way of Jesus. So here's what I would invite you to do. If you're comfortable with it, close your eyes for a moment and ask yourself where your heart is at with this invitation.